One love, one nation. Love BCFM.
Welcome back to our politics show, Mayor Hustings, with eight of the candidates for Bristol Mayor here in the studio. And I'm also joined by one who I'm afraid I only found out this morning was standing because the list was only released by the City Council officially today. That's Tom Baldwin. Do you want to tell us why we should be voting for you, Tom?
Yeah, I'm standing for the Trade Unionist and Socialist Coalition, TUSC, which was formed by Bob Crowe to give a voice back to ordinary people because we've had a raw deal over the last few years. While the rich have been getting richer, we're still paying for their crisis. We've seen falling living standards, cuts and privatisation to our vital services. And TUSC are standing because we want to make Bristol a city that is affordable for all. That means addressing the housing crisis by the building of thousands of council houses owned by us so we can guarantee quality, low rents and secure lifetime tenancies. It means raising wages. We're looking for a £10 minimum wage for council staff and pushing that as far beyond as possible. It means addressing the care and transport issues in the city with public ownership at the heart of the solutions to those. But I think most of all, it means opposing the austerity agenda that's being pushed on us. Anyone who's elected will not be able to carry out their programme without countering the huge cuts being made to Bristol's budget. And yes, that's being pushed by the Tory government, but our local representatives have so far said that there's nothing they can do but to pass them on. We've had £100 million cut in the last 4 years by Ferguson and his cross-party cabinet. That includes things like libraries, care services, city parks. And it can't go on like this. If we allow it to, it'll be nothing less than the complete destruction of those services. But there is an alternative. I would move a budget that is based on what this city needs, not on George Osborne's demands for cuts, and then build a campaign to win back what's been stolen from the city. It can be done. The Tory government were beaten on the latest round of disability cuts, and they can be beaten on this if we take a stand. 5th of May is your chance to do that, to vote against the establishment, to vote for the anti-austerity socialist alternative. And that's why I'm standing for TUSC. Thanks.
Just remind us of your name again.
Yeah, Tom Baldwin, sorry, standing for TUSC.
Thanks very much.
And Socialist Coalition.
Thanks very much, Tom. Well, as I say, welcome back to the politics show, Mayor Hustings. The list of nominees has only just been published today. So that was Tom Baldwin, who's on that list, who wasn't in the studio and hasn't been for most of the debate. But also we've got four more independent candidates standing. Tony Britt, Stony Garnett, Mayor Ku de Hindu, and also John Langley. I'll remind you who is here in a minute, but first we have to pay our tax. At least some of us do. We all need to know that our mayor can work his way around the city balance sheet and income surplus accounts. So I've asked an expert accountant to look at my copy of the City and County of Bristol's accounts from just after the Second World War in 1947. I bought it from the late, great Graham Russell, who some may know, remember, ran a bookstall in his retirement. He used to work at Fry's at St Nicholas Market. Anyway, it makes for interesting reading when compared to today. For example, the City Council used to run subsidised cafes to make sure everybody could afford to eat. It used to run the corporation buses also, which made a modest profit for ratepayers. It's equivalent today. You have to download from the council website and runs to 111 pages. But our expert accountant pulled out the two or three important pages, the only ones really worth reading. And we're going to see if we can compare the 1947 accounts to those from 2014 and 2015. First thing is to say that all the values from 1947 have been multiplied up by 35 times, which the Bank of England says gives us an equivalent in 2015. So first, I'm going to give George a little test to see if he can explain some peculiarities in the more recent figures and ask you all to take a longer look at Bristol City Council's roughly £1 billion annual spending. That's nearly £2,300 for each of the 440,000 men, women and children that live in the city. So, first of all, George, from the more recent figures, the bottom line is a surplus or deficit. The council ran a deficit in 1947, just after the war, equivalent to £10.5 million, and kept its services going. That's now the accountant reports surpluses of £19 million in 2014 and £71 million in 2015. That's a £52 million jump in just 1 year. And anyway, surely with such a surplus, we don't need to be cutting the Bush Respite Care Home for Disabled Families, or in fact anything with that sort of surplus.
Well, first of all, we don't have £1 billion budget in real terms. Two-thirds of that just goes straight through our bank account and for things like education for schools. So we're left with £345 million. And probably in real terms, after the things that we have absolutely no choice over, we've got a choice of about 10% in terms of how you can adjust that. And even those choices are pretty tough. You know that I've been investing in schemes that have enabled us to save a lot more money. I've been making quite sure that we've got a much more streamlined administration. And we have saved a huge amount of money. We've made money through sensible property deals, which have left us with less running costs, and means that we're able to retain most of the money for the key services. But you know, such things as the libraries, which are contentious. We in Bristol have saved our libraries in a way that most other cities have been unable to do, so that we have a higher concentration in terms of libraries, branch libraries per head of population, than almost any other city.
The figures, George, we get a £50 million surplus from council housing. Why aren't we able to use this, say, to build 250 more council homes with that?
Well, we are, and that's exactly what we're doing. It's just when you've got huge accounts, you need to manage those accounts wisely, as you do with a larger estate. We have spent £100 million in insulating our council estate. Now, that's really important because that's saving people's energy,
so
saving their bills.
So are we building 250 council homes a year?
No, we're not building 250 council homes a year. We can't under current government restrictions. We keep getting obstacles thrown in our way. When we are building council homes for the first time, new council homes for the first time for over 30 years in Bristol, I'm proud of that. And that is accelerating. Of course, we've only got a few now because we've only had 3 years to do it.
Okay,
but that is increasing, and will, subject to government legislation that actually is impeding us, increase.
You just said that, George. Yeah. Okay.
So just on the council homes, just as a bit of a shout out, really, there's a demonstration tomorrow in St Paul's, 11:15, Meet of the Malcolm X. Bristol City Council are just about to sell off another load of council
houses. How many, Paul?
Well, it's about 15, but the bigger issue is actually this has been happening, and it's been happening since about 2003, actually. So when you start to say to us, oh, it's only 15 homes, it's still 15 homes.
It will produce 30 homes.
Excuse me, can you not interrupt me, please, George? I'm just trying to get my point
across. Yeah, but you
keep
telling...
No. Can you explain that? Okay, George, can you explain how selling 15 homes means it's possible for us to build 30?
Well, because these are homes that are not got good access, badly insulated, need restoration, cannot be let economically, but they have a value that will probably raise us about £2.5 million. That full £2.5 million will be reinvested in social housing. The money raised in St Paul's, for instance, I've insisted will be reinvested in social housing in St Paul's. That will be efficient, accessible, lifelong homes that are much more appropriate. There will probably be about 2-for-1 in terms of the reinvestment. So
that makes good sense.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I felt like I was a bit interrupted there, actually. Basically, yeah, I mean, this is a big issue for a lot of people. This is also about gentrification of inner city Bristol. You know, it's a cultural attack on our city as well. So if you've got time to come down tomorrow, 11:15, meet Malcolm X, and the Hollis Morgan, they're going to be showing people around these cheap old drums, and we're going to make some noise and come down if you're available.
Okay, George, the rate support grant from government's down about £20 million just in the last year. At that rate, by the time it comes to vote for the next mayor in another 4 years, there won't be any rate support grant left. I think they call it revenue support grant, don't they? Why have you let the Treasury keep so much more that they collect from us here in Bristol in central government taxes like capital gains tax, income tax, VAT?
Well, we haven't let the Treasury keep any more than any other city in the UK. And we work together as the 10 core cities in the UK. That's all the cities that aren't all the major cities that aren't London and Edinburgh. I'm the only non-Labour leader, actually, as it happens, and we're absolutely aligned in this, and we work together to try and get as much as possible out of the government. And I think Bristol is doing well.
Am I right in 4 years' time there will be no rate support grant coming at all?
Well, the funding of local government is changing. We will be retaining more of our business rates. The devolution deal will also change the way we fund capital projects. So, yes, there's change, but that is why you need the sort of leadership that I'm giving, and that is making sure that we save money on administration, that we make money where we can make money, so that we help close that gap that is a widening gap over the money that we get from central government.
But it's getting bigger and bigger, isn't it?
Absolutely. It makes life really difficult. Look, I came into office to the bad news.
Public health and environment spending in Bristol's down in the last year by £17 million, from £37 million to £24 million. That's nearly halving the budget in 1 year, George.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that you get less public health. I mean, it is it's about how we spend it, and of course there is some damage to some of the services, but Bristol is doing so much better in terms of preserving its services than most other cities.
Okay, would anyone like to come back on the figures?
Yeah, just very quickly, I think this is one of those issues where the mayor just needs to get on his bike or car or train and go to Westminster and start banging on some doors. That's the whole idea of having a mayor, isn't it, really?
Well, that's what I do.
obviously not well enough, George.
It's exactly what I do, and we are doing probably better than almost others. I mean, Manchester were ahead of us because they started this whole process about 10 years ago. I was only able to start it just over 3 years ago.
Now, we're going to hear a clip now from a chap called Carl Mann. He runs something called Homeless Pay It Forward here in Bristol, with the headline in the Post last month, "More rough sleepers than anywhere else in England outside London are in Bristol." Do you think homelessness is shaping the city, shaming the city? And how will you house Bristol's 100 or so, we heard earlier, actually 200 figure of rough sleepers between now and the autumn? But let's have a listen now to Carl Mann from Homeless Pay It Forward.
I'm Carl Mann. I founded the charity Homeless Pay It Forward.
The previous mayor elections 4 years ago, George Ferguson won. In the run-up to it, there was a lot of talk about housing and homelessness by all the candidates, really promising to deliver social housing to reduce the number of people homeless, and of course it hasn't happened.
Well, they're like magicians, aren't they? Smoke and mirrors, basically. My analysis of what's going on, they're only going to ever bring it up when election time comes up. They try and brush it under the carpet, don't they? Because they don't know what to do. Basically, they haven't got a clue what to do. The government has said that they're going to give £1 million to solve the homeless problem. £1 million won't even sort out the homeless problem in London.
But what would you do? I mean, what can be done?
First of all, is all these empty properties, especially the houses the council still own, instead of selling them off, is revamp them and get them back into the system. Start making some money out of them. Affordable housing. They're building affordable houses, which aren't affordable, and they're not building the council houses.
George.
Well, we are building council houses. I absolutely accept that.
Can you give us a figure for the last year? How many council houses in the last year?
We're building about... We built and are building about 35 at the moment. We will have built about 100 by the end of this year, another 100 the next year. It's not anywhere near enough, but it's infinitely more than what was built before under previous administrations over the last 30 years. So we are on an upward trajectory.
Charles Lucas,
in spite of the government trying to trip us up on it.
Charles, this headline, "More rough sleepers than anywhere else in England outside of London," is pretty shameful, isn't it?
Absolutely. All of us in this room, from whichever party or position you're sitting around this table, we all absolutely do not want to see people sleeping rough in Bristol. Of course we don't. More needs to be done. We have a massive housing shortage here in Bristol. We need to build more houses in all sectors of the market, whether it be council housing, which I personally favour, over social housing, affordable housing, whatever you want to call it, and private housing, because we desperately need to build a huge number of houses. We also need to provide better facilities for those people in the shorter term who are currently sleeping rough, who need to be accommodated, and in my view a short-term measure for a couple of months over the winter is a step in the right direction, but we need to be providing those beds for those people all year round, and we need to give people a base from which to get a leg up to get their lives back on track.
Marvin, 200 people sleeping on the streets is not nice for them or for anybody, and it's not good for the city. Can you make any promises and commitments if you become mayor as what you'll do about this?
Well, we commit to prioritise it. I mean, the thing that surprises me about it is this did not sneak up on us. You know, we've had a lot of focus on major outward-facing events that's been about fun and been about the city narrative, and that's where I think we've got our priorities wrong. I want the arena, okay? I want world-class sports in Bristol. I want world-class activity coming to the city. But if we made the same kind of political commitment to making sure Bristol's a place in which people could afford to live, in which we sustained our substance misuse services and our mental health services that support some of the most vulnerable people in the city, if we had the same kind of political commitment to that as we did to building the city's image to the outside world, which unfortunately is not a narrative and an image that tens of thousands of people in the city are a part of, then we would have made some real progress.
What can you
commit to, Marvin? It's only in the last 3 months, to be honest, it's only in the last 3 months that we've started to get this kind of Orwellian rewrite of Bristol's history, in which we have a focus and an interest in inequality and social
inclusion.
What
will you commit to, Marvin?
Well, I'm committing to making sure it's top of our priority. I'm committing to making sure that we invest in our network of voluntary community sectors, organisations that support some of those marginalised people in the city, and committing to building homes and making sure that we protect people across the private rental sector.
Okay.
The crisis in homes and homelessness is not a surprise. It's been coming up for us
Tony
for
Dyer
years.
For the Green Party.
Okay, well, you presented us with a budget for 1947, and now we're talking about housing. So let's talk about what happened for the 30 years after that budget was produced. And what happened was, across the country, we were building council homes in this country at a rate of 150,000 a year. After 1979, when Margaret Thatcher was elected, in the 30 years following that, that dropped down to only 20,000 a year. The policies that were introduced by the Conservative government under Margaret Thatcher, and then unfortunately kept in place by the Labour government that followed it, were increasingly restrictive on councils. They placed severe restrictions on the housing revenue account, stopped it from borrowing money from outside the housing revenue account, which meant that it was almost impossible to deliver council housing. What I'm proposing, because we need solutions, we can look back at the past, but we need to look at what we need to do for the future. And what I'm proposing is to set up a separate housing company, which is outside of the housing revenue account, and that company will deliver new housing at target social rents. We're looking at building 2,000 social rent homes over the next 4 years, and we can do that by taking the pressure away from the housing revenue account, and then by taking the pressure away from the housing revenue account, that will reduce our need to have to sell off social housing to subsidise new housing.
Okay, Kay Barnard.
Yeah, well, I think Marvin was right. It is about priorities and how the decisions are made on what the council should focus on. And obviously homelessness is a real blight on the city. I mean, it's shocking in a country as wealthy as Britain, when a country like Jordan has managed to put up with at least 1 million refugees, we can't find space for a couple of hundred people in Bristol. But I don't think that the control over the budget should be in one pair of hands. One person shouldn't be able to say this. I know the full council has to agree the budget, but after that, the mayor has the right to change things. And who's choosing those priorities? We need to see the books. I mean, you can't make decisions just on the simple bare figures in front of us here. you know, we need detailed assessment of where the money's going and how it's being spent.
Okay, Paul Turner for UKIP.
Well, Mara's absolutely right. This is not something that's suddenly appeared up. I would love to better blame this on George, but it's not all his fault, because we've had homeless people in this city, sadly, for many, many decades.
I think it's fair to say it's increased over the last 2 years, George, quite a lot. Yeah,
it has.
And
I'd agree with that.
Everywhere, just
but
about.
As Mayor, one thing that I would do is the 200 people that are sleeping rough on the streets at the moment, we can house them, albeit potentially temporarily, very, very quickly, very, very cost-effectively, in prefabricated buildings that will give them security, safety, warm, dry accommodation, whilst... And we must admit that we must understand that just giving them a home is not the answer to all the problems. That is just a step in the right direction. And we must make sure that once we take that step, we take the next step and the next step to make sure that these people are housed properly at the end of the day.
Not putting people in crates like they're like they're proposing to do in Newport, over in Newport. Anyway, Paul.
Well, the reality of the situation out there is, you know, we've seen a massive increase in spice use as well, which is that funny drug. It's sprayed with over 700 chemicals, most of them untested, and I think we've had about 15 deaths recently in Bristol. That's affecting the homeless population a lot. So what I'm trying to say is that all of these issues, they're all connected, and actually, as a city, it costs us more. It costs us more because it increases crime. It's all connected. And what my solution really is what Carl said on that little excerpt that you put on, was get those empty buildings open. There's no reason. 21 days before Christmas, the council promised us that they would open empty buildings. We're now, what are we in? Oh, we're in April now. It's gone, I can't believe time's gone so quickly. They haven't opened the buildings. They put a few more beds in the on Jamaica Street in the hostel. But apart from that, we haven't seen anything. People are dying on our streets, and it's time that Bristol City Council and the service directors and the incumbent mayor and the future one, whoever he or she is, took a stand on it. And it is what Kay just said. It's about political will. If the political will is there to do something about it, it will be done.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what's been said. What I want to add, though, actually, because I was particularly insulted, and there was an article quite recently where the lead officer for housing in our local authority described the people living in tents as camping. And for me, it's really dangerous when officers are using such language in the media, because it's about othering and it's about separation. The other side of this is about how we prevent people, because street homelessness is the absolute tip of the iceberg, because we've got sofa surfing, we've got 500 children woke up this morning in temporary bed and breakfast accommodation. It's unsuitable. We've got a crisis in housing. It's huge. It's not just about the 200 people on the streets.
We're going to have a clip now from you talking there about the sort of wider problem. A lot of people hungry just simply don't have enough money to feed themselves, and one of the places that they go to on Stapleton Road is the Wild Goose Cafe. And I spoke just at the end of last week to Johnny Angel, who runs the Wild Goose Cafe, which doesn't get contributions from government deliberately. It said it doesn't want to do that. Really about how the situation for the people at the very bottom of the pile, income wise, people that can hardly afford to feed themselves, how things have been going for them.
My name is Johnny Angel, and I am the project leader of the Wild Goose Stopping Centre, a project within Crisis Centre Ministries, and we provide between 500 and 600 meals a day. So we'll provide breakfast, lunch and evening meal. Evening meals are from Sunday through to Friday, and during the daytime is Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We provide food. We ask for a donation, but if people can't provide a donation, we don't refuse them a meal. And then when they ask for help, we will engage with them in whatever means that they need, whether it's offering a phone call, access to the internet, helping with a form, or actually trying to walk alongside them to engage with other services. So we're very much about feeding people and engaging them and signposting to whatever service is best suited to them. We are a Christian charity, and so most of our funding is from people who give, churches that give, and also some trusts. We won't take any government funding, because it normally comes with targets, and for what we do, we can't set any targets. So therefore, it is very much a faith ministry. Our food is provided mainly from Fair Share, so we have a daily delivery, which is either on its use-by date or close to its best-before date. And when the food comes in, we then decide what we're going to cook during the day. We also get donations from schools and churches and individuals. So I sort of describe working in the kitchen as ready, steady, cook on an extremely large scale, because we don't have a menu, because we don't necessarily know what we're going to cook each day. We have 450 to 500 volunteers, we have two full-time and one part-time staff, including myself, running the Goose. So if we didn't have volunteers, which are Christians from other churches, we wouldn't be able to actually provide the service that we do. 5 years ago, we were feeding, 70, 80 people. We most probably feed between 300 and 400 people now. So the number of meals that we provide is higher because people normally have seconds or thirds if they can. We have noticed an increase in people coming in. Not a huge increase because it's been like this for the last few years, 2-3 years. But we've seen a cross range and a greater diversity of people coming and using our services. And again, that's it. So where a lot of people felt that we were just here for those in addiction, now the service users come from a much more diverse range across society.
Well, obviously a growing number of people, not just rough sleepers, obviously, but a lot of more people who just simply cannot afford to feed themselves in the city. I'm just going to go around everybody now, one by one, and ask what we can do to reverse this trend, starting with you, Christine Townsend.
For me, it's about making sure that there are support services in and around the people that are using the Wild Goose Cafe that will enable them to find safe spaces and trust workers, whether those are paid or volunteer workers, so they are able to open up and allow services to support them so that they aren't in the position where that's how they're needing to feed themselves.
Yeah, the Wild Goose Space is an amazing, amazing service, really, isn't it? And considering it takes no government funds as well, it's even more fantastic. Again, the reality of the situation is that on Stapleton Road, as many people will or may not know, is there's often a queue all the way down the road, and it is very something kind of like it's very 1930s about it, you know, the workhouse poor. And I think that's what George Osborne and his Tory government want to do, is take us back to a Victorian era. So I think more support should be going to the Wild Goose Space, really.
Well, I think it just proves that the austerity measures imposed by the government are just not working. To think that some of these people are obviously sort of homeless and addictions, but a lot of the people there are just people who just cannot afford to feed themselves and are obviously struggling in other ways as well, just to keep their head above water. And this is where, again, I think that the mayor's role comes in several ways. Firstly, to start challenging the government on those austerity measures, and secondly, to make sure that people are supported properly in the community. And we hinted on it earlier, and I said it at the beginning of the programme, this is again down to spending prioritisation, and it just shows that the priorities of our current authority are just completely ski-whiffed.
Yeah, well, we seem to be going back to Victorian times, don't we? Not just the 1930s. And people are struggling to survive on the minimum wage, sometimes working two or three jobs just to keep their family afloat. So, yeah, absolutely, we need support services. And the food that gets wasted by the supermarkets, I think that's really great that it's reused and not just thrown and sent off to landfill. Something that's positive out of what should not be happening anyway.
Tony?
Well, I'm going to go back to the 1947 budget again because you brought it in. If we look back at 1945, we had a Labour government elected that was facing an economic crisis that was even worse than what we're facing today, because it was an entire continent had been devastated by war. And what they did, they invested in the country. They basically put in a programme of public works to do work. They created full employment, giving people jobs, jobs that were paying a decent wage. It didn't work overnight. I have members of my family that were buried in a pauper's grave in 1959. So we still did have huge amounts of poverty even after that. But that's what we need to do now as well. And we can do some of that locally. We can insist that we have a living wage paid within the council, and that's the real living wage, not the fake one. That we insist on the council's suppliers also have a living wage, and also that we invest in those areas of the economy that create decent jobs. At the moment, one of the most thriving parts of the economy, as long as the government stays out of its way, is the green economy, and we can create jobs that way.
Marvin Rees.
Yeah, I think this actually tests us as a city in that it's not... we have to have a kind of a change of mindset. This is not just about Bristol City Council. I think that the Wild Goose is a fantastic example, actually, of stuff being done outside of the City Council's resources. So we have a thriving community voluntary sector, somewhat, even though some of them have, like Hawkspring, recently came to the edge of existence, saved the game by a private funder. But also we have two big universities, we have a health service, we have a police service. If we want to have real social impact in Bristol, we have to look at how we mobilise priorities and resources and strategies across all those cities' institutions. Otherwise, it's just the 350 that the council spend, 350 council spend every year. I think, too, there is a broader piece. There's a fantastic proverb says, don't strain gnats and swallow camels. You know, while we take action on a local level, there is a piece of work to be done on city leadership, which is about challenging political priorities in general. And it has to be that it is not just about having the economy grow. In some sense, in many ways, we've reached the end of what economic growth alone can do for us as a policy tool. It has to be about tackling inequality and inclusion. If we don't do that, not only will we undermine the future of our economic prosperity, but actually we'll be in political crisis because there will be no political stability. And we saw evidence of that, I think, in 2011. Such loose ties to our common story that people were willing to go on the street and riot at the smallest instigation.
Okay.
So inequality is essential.
Okay, Charles Lucas, this general situation of people, some of them working people, simply not able to feed themselves.
Well, this is a personal priority of mine, and certainly something that I will attempt to tackle if I'm elected in May. The Wild Goose Cafe is a fantastic organisation. I have been and seen it. I'm actually a volunteer with the Bristol Soup Run Trust on a regular basis, and we go out and we do in sort of working in cohesion with Wild Goose and other organisations such as St Mungo's, we do go out and help those who are sleeping rough, who are hungry. And that is something that shouldn't be necessary in Bristol in 2016. I'm sure we all agree that. We need to address this issue as an absolute top priority.
Okay, Charles, how?
Sorry.
Address it how?
How? Well, we need to increase our... In my view, we need to increase funding to address both issues, homelessness and hunger.
Okay, George.
I think we have to deal with the fundamentals. I hate the fact that charity is having to pick up society's problems, but that is the current situation. I talked about greater redistribution of wealth within the city if we had a local income tax rather than a council tax. I think we are a kind city in general. We were nominated as the kindest city in the UK. I mean, that's to me is the best thing we could possibly have. So there are individuals. I was talking to Fair Share the other day who are doing great work. They're now distributing tons of food every day, and that is absolutely brilliant. But the fundamental is that we get everybody into full decent employment. We are doing well in that, but it's still leaving a lot of people behind. And I want to close that gap. We've still got nearly 6% unemployment amongst men and 3% amongst women. It's lower amongst women almost than any other city. I don't know, that may be down to some special reasons, but we've got to keep on looking to achieve full employment.
Okay,
across the city.
Some say the mayor has turned Bristol into a dictatorship. not George personally, but just having a mayor and diminish the power of councillors to represent us. So maybe people are thinking, well, what's the point of voting for a councillor if actually it's only the mayor that has the power? Now there's talk of a metro mayor for the Bristol City region. Do you support this idea, and will you be standing, George?
Yes and no. Yes, I do support it as part of the deal, because you've got to have some sort of governance for the combined authority services that will come out of this. And no, I won't be standing okay. for it, because I'm only dedicated to making quite sure I finish this job okay. and that Bristol ends up better for it.
Just let's go back 4 years and see what your answer to that question was 4 years ago when you were on our Mayor Hustings that we held. I think George, you're the only you're the only person who is in this room now who was in the same room 4 years ago, or three and a half years ago.
That's true.
I wish I was standing to be mayor of the metropolitan area so that we could get our heads around all those big transport and homes and other issues that we share with our neighbours. I think we've got to have very creative partnerships between us and the neighbours that have failed to really gel so far. So not only do we need an integrated transport authority, I think we need an integrated planning authority that looks at how we plan for homes for the future. And we're going to need a lot more, and we're going to need a lot more actually that are even being promised by the absent candidate. And I think to do that, we're going to have to look at the rental levels that enable the housing associations to build, because new regulations have come in, or new guidance has come in from the government via the HCA, the Housing Communities Agency, that means that unless one adjusts those rental levels, then the housing associations are not going to be able to produce the housing. So there's a big discussion to be had there across a lot of different private and public partners.
Well, I suppose it's not fair, really. George, you've got a double go there from 4 years ago as well. But let's go around everybody else to see what you make of this whole idea of a metro mayor, starting with you, Kay Barnard, from the Lib Dems. What would it mean for the city, and are you in favour of a metro mayor?
No, I'm not in favour of a metro mayor. It's yet another layer of government, and I think that's a silly idea. What we need is the four councils in the area to work together sensibly to solve the problems over housing and transport. Absolutely. And I pledge to, if I can, to push for another referendum. I mean, it was the Lib Dems who managed to get it reinstated in legislation that Bristol could have another referendum. We were barred from it previously. And I think the recent vote in Bath, where there was a massive vote against having a mayor, showed they'd been looking over their shoulders at what had been going on in Bristol. And I think they decided they didn't like what they saw.
Tony?
Well, Greens in general, and myself in particular, are in favour of devolution. I think it's always better to try and have decision-making made as close as possible to the people that are most affected by it. But for that to happen, you need to have a governance structure that allows transparency and scrutiny by members of the public and also their elected representatives. My concern is that the model we've got at the moment doesn't provide that. And with this Metro Mayor, it's a Metro Mayor which is going to have a cabinet, I understand, of possibly five people, which will be the leaders of each of the local authorities involved, plus the Metro Mayor himself. So I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done about the democracy and transparency. And also, I think the other problem all of us are facing is that this deal has been done to a certain extent under a cloud of secrecy, and so little is known about it, and I think we need to have more open discussions about what has actually been agreed.
Marvin Rees, do you support the idea of a Metro Mayor? Will you be supporting this?
I'm really concerned about the imposition of another political structure on the area. I think the question should have been, can you display the behaviours we want, which is much more joined up working across local authority boundaries? So, I mean, we're locked into it. I'm going to say we'll go with the Metro Mayor because it is a gateway to getting those devolution of powers and resources that we actually need. But with a very heavy caveat that we must be able to negotiate to make sure that what we're not getting is more concentrations of power. But you asked two questions, Tony, because you also asked about concentrations of power in Bristol and the position of elected members, and I think that is a very, very important issue. In the briefings we had before the last mayoral election, we were told one of the first decisions we'd have to make if we won was how much of our executive power would we share with the cabinet. And I think the fact that no power has been shared with the cabinet, and that the position of the people that we elect into Bristol City Council have been undermined because they have no power, has been absolutely disastrous for Bristol's economy. And when you don't listen to people, when you keep all power, then you make bad decisions and you end up running over the hill and taking no one with you. And we haven't had leadership in Bristol, we've had rulership. And that's a major challenge for Bristol.
Charles Lucas.
Tony, I sit before you as a councillor on Bristol City Council. Basically, in my opinion, councillors, certainly since I've been elected, are impotent. We have absolutely no role to play in decision-making in Bristol beyond the budget, and even that can be overruled. So one of the key policies of my campaign is that I have pledged to introduce a council veto, where if whoever the mayor is heading off down a road with some policy that the majority of councillors, i.e. of the 70 democratically elected representatives of the people of Bristol, if 75% of those councillors want to stop the mayor heading off on a path that they do not agree with, they can block that policy. I'm already committed to that. Just to answer the second part of your question, I am in favour of a Metro Mayor, and I'm in favour of a Metro Mayor because Bristol and the West of England need the devolution deal. It is a condition of the deal that's being offered by central government, and we want devolution. I'm entirely pro the devolution bill and the investment it will bring to Bristol.
But it's almost as if, sorry to challenge you, but you know, it's almost like you're saying, well, yes, I agree, the mayor is a dictator and it doesn't really work, but I want
an
uber-grippen dictator over the top of the mayor.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is I wholeheartedly support the mayoral system in Bristol. I think it is better. If you look at the 20 to 30 years, most recent years before the mayoral system was introduced, we had a succession of Labour and Liberal Democrat administrations that actually did get nothing done. We all agree that.
But how
Bristol
does that
stagnated.
See?
Hang on, let me finish, sir. Tony. Bristol stagnated. So the mayoral system is better because one individual has the power to make difficult decisions. It doesn't get bogged down in party
politics.
But
how does that sit with the impotence of councillors now?
Well, that's why I'm saying the councillors must have the opportunity to influence the mayoral decision.
Paul.
Well, I think from a local mayor point of view, it does raise the question of how democratic is the city. Going back a slight step, I would like to say I agree an awful lot with what Tony was saying from a working with our neighbouring authorities point of view. It is essential if we're going to have some degree of transportation system that's actually going to work not only for Bristol but for the South West. So I do agree a lot with what Tony is saying about devolution of powers and working with our neighbours, but that does not necessarily mean that we need a Metro Mayor running it as we've got a Mayor trying to run Bristol at the moment. From a local point of view, having one person in place that can, for all intents and purposes, ignore the other 70 people that have been elected does draw very, very serious questions over our democratic system that we're operating in Bristol and whether it's actually working or not. No one man or woman has all the answers and knows everything, and the whole idea of having a mayor is, as far as I'm concerned, is to be looking at what the councillors and the councillors are doing, bringing people together, and if need be, being that deciding vote, not necessarily making all the decisions on their own individually.
Okay, Paul Savile, what's your take on this Metro Mayor?
Yes, I'm not in support of it at all. I think, well, the big thing really is even as we're talking about it now, it seems like it's going to be forced upon Bristol and Bristolians anyway. Surely it should be up to Bristolians to decide, not for council bosses and council workers to decide for us. That's up to everyday Bristolians to decide. That's direct democracy. I'm really in favour of direct democracy, bringing things back to a grassroots level, so communities can decide what's best for them, rather than having this, you know, this real top-down hierarchy. Go the whole hog dictatorship, which we've seen over the past 3.5 years, and I think a lot of Bristolians would agree with me that it's just another layer of government, really.
I suppose if it's a dictatorship at the moment, there's about to be a coup next month when everyone votes. Anyway, Christine, I mean, there is a wider issue here, that if we widen the electorate who's going to vote on a Metro Mayor, the chances are, if you look at the equivalent councils around, it might be Conservative, whereas Labour tends to not vote for Conservatives to put them in charge of everything. Anyway, what are your thoughts about this Metro Mayor?
Well, actually, it's largely along those lines. I mean, the area that the Metro Mayor would cover are hugely different. We've got very rural areas just outside Bristol, very different demographics, and then we've got a hugely multicultural city with particular concentrations in particular parts of our city. And I would struggle to envisage one elected person that would be able to truly represent and understand all of those areas. Now, I know that one of these arguments is, well, we have Avon and Somerset Police, but the structures within the police are broken down, so that actually what the police, the force that are operating in Bristol, are very, very different to those that are operating in and around Somerset, and the priorities are able to be different. Governance and scrutiny, those are the two areas that I'm interested in kind of seeing around this with the Metro Mayor. And it's another layer of gatekeepers, quite honestly, that just makes somebody that's supposed to be democratically elected further away from those that they're actually representing.
George is using his opportunity to come in here.
Yeah. I'd just like to stress, there's a very different sort of mayor to the city mayor. And basically, the mayor becomes the chair of a cabinet, and the cabinet is made up of the four leaders of the four authorities. And there are very few decisions that would be mayor-only decisions. So it is a cooperative in terms of the governance of the four authorities. And I don't think this is really all about the Metro Mayor. I know that's where the media has been looking, but this is about £1 billion deal for the Greater Bristol region. And
Over quite a long period, George.
Yes, but we can borrow up front against it in order to invest, in order to make money, in order to make jobs, in order to build skills.
It sounds like bribery.
You might put it that way, Tony, in terms of the politics, and I wouldn't absolutely deny it, but it's a deal that would be damn stupid for us to turn down.
Okay, Tony Dyer.
Yeah, I was interested at the beginning of that, George. You said that this would be a much better system because there would be a cabinet and they were all have will all have decision making powers, what you seem to imply. So why aren't we having that already in Bristol?
Well, we do in effect. You know that I've got a rainbow cabinet, and it's a similar structure. It's the mayor and four assistant mayors for people, place, neighbourhoods, and business change.
Let me ask you a very straight question. Very simple one. You've answered very easily.
Yeah.
Will the Metro Mayor, will the other four local authority leaders be able to outvote the Metro Mayor?
Yes, in most. Yes, in
does
most
that happen
conditions.
In your cabinet at the moment?
They've never have I made a decision against the majority of the cabinet.
Can they outvote you in your cabinet at the moment?
No, and I think that's right. That's okay. Otherwise, it would simply go back to the old dithering party politics that used to hold Bristol back before we had a mayoral system.
Okay, George, we're going to go on now, and we'll start with Christine Townsend, because the government has just announced that it will be forcing all our schools to become academies. Is this good for the next generation of young Bristolians?
The idea that central government would force any local authority school to become an academy, I find absurd. There isn't evidence that the academy structure is necessarily better than the local authority. In fact, it's the opposite. The recent Education Select Committee report actually said there is no evidence that academies are better than local authority schools. No.
Paul Saville.
again, it's down to privatisation, isn't it? They want to get into every kind of area of public service and just privatise everything for monetary gain. So, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
Okay, Paul Turner?
Well, I'm no expert on education, so on subjects like this, I would bow down to Christine's much superior knowledge and expertise in it, which I think is really where a mayor should come in, really, is to look for the people who actually know and are experts in fields and actually use them as advisors to make decisions.
OK, for the Lib Dems, Kay Barnard.
No, absolutely not a sensible policy at all. I mean, even worse, they're going to get rid of the parent governors. So the parents of the kids at the school will actually have no say at all in the way the school is run. I think that's pretty bad.
This government seems to be trying to produce a rose series of policies which are going to go into the list of the worst ever policies introduced by any government ever existed. It's a really awful idea. It takes away the whole idea of academies in the first place. We're supposed to be allowing parents to have a greater say. Now they're doing the opposite. They're taking away any involvement of parents in governing the schools. It's an awful idea.
Marvin?
It's very bad policy, and it seems to be driven more by ideology and a commitment to rolling back any influence and undermining the ability of local government to operate rather than it is based on evidence. And I'm particularly concerned about the undermining of local accountability and obviously, as Kay just mentioned as well, I mean, taking parents out. Schools have to be connected to local communities. They have to be connected to parents. And if they're not, we lose the opportunity to influence, which is one of the flagship policy areas, the flagship interventions that we have to be able to hold to account and to shape if we're going to have any hope of kind of delivering the kind of society we want.
Charles Lucas, this is the next generation. Quite a lot of concern about this policy.
Well, of course there's concern. I imagine I'm going to be isolated on this particular one because I personally think it's a very sound policy. I think there is tremendous potential for this. And if you look at education, I can only speak with any fraction of knowledge and nothing like the knowledge that Christine has, but I can speak with a fraction of knowledge of the Bristol education, that since academies were first introduced, the quality of education in Bristol and the results that are being achieved have improved. There is no denying that. And the organisations that have come in and are delivering a better education to our children, I have to say that I personally believe it to be a good step, because ultimately all of us want is the best education possible for all the young people in Bristol and across the country. The one thing I would say that I don't agree with the policy of academisation is that I do believe that parents should be involved. I think there is a role for parents in all schools.
Okay, before we go to George, quickly, Marvin and Christine want you to come in. Marvin first.
I was just interested to hear from Charles what he thought that potential was. He said a tremendous potential in academisation, enforced academisation.
The potential is that the education that will be provided to the young people of Bristol and right across the country will be better than was delivered under recent administrations here in Bristol. There has been a marked improvement in recent years.
Do you sympathise, do you have any space at all for those people that are pointing out the warning signs of lost local accountability, increased selection
okay,
in schools?
That'll do, yeah. Charles, just quickly, if you can reply to that.
All these issues need to be addressed. Of course they do. And, we haven't seen the fine print of the bill or the deal that's being proposed. But, of course, where there are concerns, they need to be addressed,
Christine.
Marvin.
In the previous hour, Charles, you identified the Merchants Academy being sponsored by the Merchant Ventures as a really good example of a school that's been turned around 4 years ago. You could have said the same, actually, about City Academy, which was also a Merchant Venture-involved school, still is a Merchant Venture on the chair of the body. It's since been done for institutional racism. It's now in special measures and it's in its second year. The Merchants Academy in November 2015 was investigated by the adjudicator and was found to have unlawful admissions arrangements.
Sorry, you mean City Academy?
City Academy, yes. John Laycock is a merchant venturer, and if you want to see the evidence that the City Academy, the Merchants Academy, the Bristol Cathedral and Colston Girls School are merchant venturer-involved schools, then I can show you that evidence.
Anyway.
But that is what the merchant venturer sponsors
George.
In this city has done to our state education system.
George Ferguson, should we be forcing schools to all become academies?
No. I think it's a very dogmatic approach. It's an example of centralised governance. I think it should be local choice and school choice. Now, I come dogma-free in this case. What I mind about is results, and that's why I'm very interested in what Christine has to say. I think Christine's got a lot of knowledge in this particular area, and I will always take a judgment by what will produce the best result.
Okay, now we've only got a couple of minutes, but a really quick fire round, final round of questions. The EU referendum, should Britain stay in or get out, and why? Let's start with UK Barnard.
Well, I think I approach this from the point of view of Bristol. Bristol's a hugely international city, and a lot of the companies have partners or work with other companies in Europe. So as far as Bristol concerned, absolutely we should stay in.
Tony?
You want a very quick answer? I'll give you a very quick answer. We should stay in.
Marvin?
Stay in. And I think it's worth pointing out, I think many of the out arguments boil down to, well, 50 years ago, we were a global power. But it's not 50 years ago. We're now in an interdependent world. And I think it's old school to be saying we should be leaving.
Charles Lucas?
In which case, I'm old school because I'm out.
George Ferguson?
Well, I think it'd be economic and social madness, actually. I mean, I know that we put more in as a country, but I tell you, as a city, we benefit hugely, and that's where I look at it from. Bristol has benefited enormously, both directly and also indirectly. Our universities have benefited enormously through...
Christine?
Ian?
Stay in.
I'm still making my mind up, still don't know, but I do think it's another case of divide and rule.
And I guess we'll finish with somebody who I think we know the answer from the UK Independence Party.
You're making assumptions there, but yes, I'm for out. And the main reasons are the complete lack of democracy in the European Union and also the extraordinary high level of corruption. Yes, George is right, we do get funding here from Europe, but that is only taxes that we already create here and send to Europe in the first place. We get roughly less than 50% back into this country of the funding we send to the European Union in the first place. So I'm definitely out.
I'll just make a final comment. I look at the state of the country since we joined in 1975 make my mind up based on that. But anyway, we've been you've been hearing from Bristol First, George Ferguson, from the Conservatives, Charles Lucas, from Labour, Marvin Rees, from Lib Dems, Kay Barnard, Green Party, Tony Dyer, from UKIP, Paul Turner, Independence for Bristol, Christine Townsend, and also Independent, Paul Saville. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next is the Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. You can listen again to the show online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm away next week at the delegate meeting of the National Union of Journalists, but we'll be back with the Politics Show, God willing, in a fortnight. And in 3 weeks, on the 29th of April, we'll do what we just did all again with the police and crime.